Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is former Tulsan Ann Patton, now resident of Orlando, Florida. Patton was a former reporter, a community activist, a government official, and later government consultant in Tulsa, and in recent years has been writing books about Tulsa's Neighbor for Neighbor founder, Father Dan Allen, or the history of the Arkansas River here in Tulsa. But her latest book tackles a dark episode in American history with reverberations that move today, both nationally and locally. Unmask, The Rise and Fall of the 1920s Ku Klux Klan documents the rise of the Midwestern Klan that rose and fell on the back of its young charismatic leader, David Curtis Stevenson, a flamboyant leader born in Texas who worked as a newspaperman here in Oklahoma in the teens before building the Klan into the most potent political force in the state of Indiana, as well as several other Midwestern states. Stevenson captured the attention of millions and was touted as a possible future national political figure until he was convicted of a brutal assault and rape of a young librarian. Ann Patton tells the story of the rise and fall of Stevenson and with him the rise and fall of the Klan in Indiana that controlled virtually every political figure in the state. The name of the book is Unmask, The Rise and Fall of the 1920s Ku Klux Klan, and she joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Ann Patton, welcome back to Studio Tulsa, and welcome back to Tulsa. We miss you here in Tulsa.
Oh, thank you so much, Rich. It is a great thing to be back.
I want to ask you, you've been writing about things here in Tulsa since you retired, and now all of a sudden you take on this very different story, the story of the 1920s version of the Klan, and a man with Oklahoma ties. But what made you decide to write about the Ku Klux Klan in the 20s?
A friend of mine told me about this story. His name was Neil McDaniel. He died last year. He was the city attorney in the 80s and the 90s. And Neil told me about this story. It turned out that Neil McDaniel's father had been in the state Supreme Court and was a justice of the court in the 20s, and the Klan fought him, and he fought the Klan. And if my memory is right, the Klan beat him. So Neil grew up with this story, so he knew the story intimately, and he was able to steer me into the right research, guide my research as I explored this story. So I've always been very grateful to him, and I dedicated this book to Neil McDaniel.
Yeah, and so what was it about the story that intrigued you? The whole issue of the Klan revival in the 1920s, and what a tight stranglehold it had on a lot of state houses in the 1920s, Oklahoma included. There were major battles against the Klan here, between the Klan and some politicians and Klan controlling politicians in Oklahoma. But it was the same thing through Missouri, same thing in Indiana, which is the heart of where your story takes place. What interests you in this?
This is a story that speaks to me and I hope other people on many levels. In one sense, it's a true crime story about a horrendous rape and murder in Indiana in the 20s. That's one level. And the trial, and another level is the political level, which is probably what drew me in originally. So the main character, David Curtis Stevenson, who was trained in Oklahoma, wanted to be president. It was all about power and money for him. But he clothed himself a very noble leader of men. So the story speaks to today's political climate, I think, very strongly too, because the Klan in the 20s was not the Klan you think about when you think about the Klan after the Civil War. This was a different organization.
And this is one of the things. The Klan was, it was certainly pro-white, anti-immigration, a white Protestant organization. I think that's probably the best way to put it. It was pro-white Protestant organization, probably against Catholics, definitely against Jews, against immigration. But it was also, it was a very different Klan from the 1880s. The 1870s and 1880s, those were the Knight Riders. They were about terrorizing newly freed blacks in the South and basically to try to keep them in some form of a sharecropper system or some as close to the plantation system as they could get. What was the Klan of the 1920s like?
The 1920s Klan was a business first, created by an idealist who was quickly supplanted by business people. And their goal was to make money and amass power. And they did it by creating a men's fraternity.
And a women's auxiliary.
Eventually.
Yeah.
But it was originally a men's fraternity. And then how were they going to sell it? There was a new science in those days called public relations. So they sold it to the country based on this new science of public relations. But don't forget, the bottom line was money and power. That's what they were interested in. Money first. Power came later.
Now, did they have a lot of the beliefs that we expect to see from the Klan? Not necessarily as law-breaking, we thought, during the 1920s, than, say, the 1950s and 60s Klan or the Reconstruction Klan. But was there still a hatred of others, if you will?
What sold? Here's the bottom line.
It's what sold.
So if you go into a town and they're all afraid of immigrants, which was pretty constant throughout the country, then you capitalized on that fear. And you shaped your program around that fear. So if they were upset about Catholics, which was a very pervasive Klan tenet, then you said, the Pope is coming any day to take over the government. And that was how you shaped your program. So common themes were 100% Americanism. That was common. And many, many, many of the Klansmen were white Protestants. So white supremacy became a good part of the program. But again, it just depended on where you were. If you were in the South and they were anti-black, then that's what you did. That's how it started. But it was a secret organization. But
by the 1920s, it had become less secretive.
Yes, but they never wanted anyone to know how many members they had or who was in it. That was the goal, you know, that was the mask. The name of my book is Unmasked, mm-hmm. The Rise and Fall of the 1920s Ku Klux Klan. And Unmasked is, it was the secretness of it that I think bred the evil. So start with a business, start with money, sell it on the regional fears, and decide who you're going to hate, and then drum up that, get people in a lather about whatever it is you're going to hate. A big part of Tulsa was a lawless town. So the Klan decided who was immoral, and if that was the issue, then you go after the immoral people. There are cases when the Klan actually broke into a house and arrested, in Klan terms, or terrorized people playing cards. So they thought they could do no wrong. So as the Klan went on, it was, I don't want to say taken over at the beginning, but here came this character, David Curtis Stevenson, who had been trained in Oklahoma. He was
a newspaper man at one point.
He was. Actually, he was part of setting up the Oklahoma Press Association, as a matter of fact. He was one of the founders of that group. And he was perhaps a socialist.
A one-time socialist. Now, you have to remember in the 19-teens and 20s, well, mainly in the teens and the aughts, right, I suppose, this was a hotbed of socialism. I mean, socialism's, we had the Wobblies all, you know, of course, during World War I, there was almost a civil war in Oklahoma to get rid of the Wobblies. But we had this large socialist movement, and socialist candidates got lots of votes in presidential elections from Oklahoma.
Steve was quite a fascinating character. And he would go and make speeches for the socialist one day, and then the next day go and make a speech against them. So he had a pretty flexible moral standard. But Steve perfected a formula for creating power, and he was no more than 30. He was really not even 30 when he got there.
He was very much a charismatic speaker.
Yes, he was self-trained. He memorized the dictionary as a young man. He memorized all the stuff that he set the type on, and it was hand-set type, by the way, if you think about that, at the newspapers. And so he would speak, they said, for all day and all night, and nobody left. He trained himself by speaking in front of a mirror. So he was a genius, but he used it in evil ways, I would say.
So how did he go from Oklahoma to the Klan and being the Grand Dragon in Indiana, the head of the state Klan in Indiana, which for a time in the 1920s ruled the state? It ran the politicians. It had most of the politicians in the state on the take or on the rolls, if you will. How did he go from Oklahoma to Indiana?
Well, he went to set up businesses, but Steve's pattern pretty much was he was editor of these small newspapers, and whenever the bills came due, he'd move on. So he was, as I said, pretty flexible morally and ethically. So he went to set up a business or to escape whatever he was running from. He'd had a wife or two.
Apparently he had two wives by the time he settled in Indiana,
yes,
who he abandoned.
And that pattern becomes very obvious much later in the book. And you understand the pattern later. So they hired him to become a Klegel, in the Klan in Evansville, Indiana.
What was a Kleagle?
A Kleagle was a salesman.
Ah.
So remember, it was a business. So he became a pyramid-style business. So he became a Kleagle to Klucks, as they called it, Indiana, to set up Klan chapters. So that's how he started. And within 2 years, he owned the state. He married the Klan to the Protestant Church, first of all, law enforcement, second, and eventually to the Republican Party. The Republican Party of Indiana and the Klan had become one before Steve was through. And it was just a couple of years.
Now, that's a very different Klan history than we're used to hearing about because, frankly, in Reconstruction and in the 1950s and 60s, we think of Klan politics being intertwined with Democratic politics. The Southern Democrats, after the Civil War, they were the minority party. Republicans were the majority party. That was the party of Lincoln. But all of a sudden, in the 1920s, he attaches it to the Republican Party. How did that happen?
Well, and the fallout of that was that the Republican Party's constituency changed dramatically after the Klan, because this Republican idea went from Indiana. Steve was beginning to take it elsewhere. And so, as I said, he intended to be president. He was building an empire. So
that's hard for people to imagine that a leader of the Ku Klux Klan was saying, okay, I'm going to be president. But give us a sense of the rallies they had in Indiana. I mean, now this was a matter of some conjecture of how many people actually were there, but right. The public relations was it was a quarter of a million people.
Yes, of course, the Klan was secret and therefore innumerable. You couldn't say, so the Klan could make up numbers. But I was going to say that the black population largely left the Republican Party because of the Klan. So that's one of the reasons I think this story is important. There was a dramatic political shift. The Republican Party was a good vehicle for him in Indiana. And yes, the Indiana Klan was different. Steve's statement was, I didn't sell the Klan in Indiana on violence. I sold it on 100% Americanism. But part of the formula for the Klan, part of the formula for amassing power, and I want to mention this because I see it happening so much today, is find the regional fear, build on that fear. But the formula also demands a certain percentage of rough stuff.
A little 2%. Bit of vigilantism
exactly right.
Was always a part of the Klan.
Once you own the law enforcement, once you own the clergy, the Protestant clergy, once you own the political mechanism, then you're free to do a lot of stuff. And Steve had learned in Oklahoma about a group called the Horse Thief Association that had legal protection to go out and do vigilante stuff. So when you stray into the vigilante stuff in a secret organization is, I think, when you get into trouble. And they got into a lot of trouble, even in Indiana, certainly in Tulsa and Oklahoma and many other places in the nation.
Now, the first half of the 1920s, Stevenson is amassing major power. He's become the head of the Klan in Indiana, and he's actually sort of created this network which split off from the national organization of the Klan. He was sort of forming his own Klan.
Absolutely. He was a great threat to the national leaders.
Was he going to other states and speaking the same way?
Yes.
How big did Klan involvement get in some of these other states? I always remember the history of Harry S. Truman. You know, it's never been proven that he was a member of the Klan, but it's this thought that he was in the Klan. And it was sort of a given in some of these Midwestern states that you had to be a member of the Klan to get elected.
You really have to. If you look back and judge the people who were in the Klan then, there's plenty to be appalled about. But you do have to understand the context of the time. It was a violent time. There were hundreds of lynchings in this country between the Civil War and the early 1920s. And they were community festivals. You'd bring the children and everybody go down and watch this horrendous act. I know, it's hard to imagine. When you think we haven't made any progress in life, you can remember that little piece. So it was in the, you know, I mean, the Tulsa Race Riot was pre-Klan. It was a violent society in many ways. And there was a lot of reason, I guess, that people thought the law enforcement wasn't enough, that you had to do the vigilante stuff. But the best numbers I've seen, and they're all conjecture, is that there were about 1 million Klansmen in Indiana and 3 to 4 million nationally. And the largest rally I know about that I thought the numbers were halfway reasonable were about 60,000. There was a march on Washington in 25. That was the peak of the Klan. And then they began to go downhill for reasons that I believe had to do, at least in large measure, with David Curtis Stevenson.
Yeah. In some of your reporting on some of these rallies that were at the height of the Klan's influence in Indiana, you have these wonderful reporters that were sort of debunking the numbers at these rallies. There was a great reporter, I can't remember the
John Niblock.
Yeah. And
he's the hero of the book.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about him.
John Niblock is a wonderful character, I think. And yes, my thesis, of course, I'm an old reporter, you know that.
Yeah.
So I see a lot of things through journalistic eyes. And John Niblock wrote an autobiography that is just a wonderful book. So I knew I had a lot of insight into him. So he was a young upstart at the beginning of the story when David Curtis Stevenson had his first big rally called the Kokomo Conclave. And there was Stevenson, by all reports, in a purple gown, and the adoring throngs were throwing their jewelry to him. But Niblock saw a very different version. He was quite sardonic about it all. And he had the good fortune to work for the Indianapolis Times. It was the afternoon newspaper. There were two big powerhouse newspapers in Indianapolis. But the Times was the little upstart, just like Niblock. It was nimble, and he had an editor who would not stop. So a lot of the journalists were either terrified, with good reason, as a matter of fact, of the Klan, or bought off by the Klan. But the Times never was, and Niblock never was. He's a great character, and now here's how I see it. The Klan represented dark, evil, secret. And Niblock and the press, because that's all there was then, the press, represents to me openness, sunshine, honesty, and putting out the facts in ways that can mobilize public opinion.
Now, when you went back to those newspaper accounts, you look at the Times account, it would be one account. I would assume the big morning newspapers had a different, totally different account?
Well, certainly in terms of editorials, for sure.
Yeah.
Yes, and yes. Actually, yeah, I'd say that they were quite different.
They were buying the public relations
right.
of the Klan.
Right.
Because
right.
this was an integral part of the Klan at this particular point. They were trying to influence public opinion in every way possible.
And the Klan was, in many ways, it was sold so well that in many ways it was for a few years a very much respected part of the community. So if you wanted to get ahead in a lot of these towns, you had to join the Klan. That was just how it was.
What happened that changed the fortunes of the Klan? It all begins, as you mentioned, with David Curtis Stevenson. First, I want to remind folks you're listening to Studio Tulsa, and my guest today is Ann Patton, a former Tulsan who's served in many roles, from reporter to a community activist to an official and author as well. And her latest book is Unmasked, The Rise and Fall of the 1920s Ku Klux Klan. So the story changes, with David Curtis Stevenson. He has amassed lots of power. People are actually starting to talk about him as a possible national candidate, if you will. He's drawing immense crowds, long, stem-winding speeches that seem to keep people spellbound, very much a demagogic figure at a time when fears are aroused, even though it's still the 1920s. There's a lot of fears of this new wave of immigration that's coming in,
right.
into the United States. We had this huge wave of immigration during the 1920s after the First World War. He's capitalizing on them. What happens that changes his fortunes?
Two things happened. One, David Curtis Stevenson, let's call him Steve, because okay. a lot of people call him Steve. Steve got crosswise with the National Klan because he was a pretty raw, ambitious guy, if you really knew what was behind this pleasant mask. The other thing was that Steve stumbled, as I say in the promotional material. Steve stumbled. He had some flaws that weren't shown to most people. He had an uncommon fondness for alcohol and women, and was a pretty brutal fellow when he was drunk. So he stumbled and was accused of the rape and murder of a young woman, a young librarian. So actually, he was. There's no question that he had. He did the rape, it was clear, and brutally assaulted her. And too graphic to go into but she ended up taking poison because she was so distraught. And disfigured, and
yeah.
it was a terrible thing. So anyway, Steve went to trial.
Now, was there some question of whether he would be brought to trial because of his power at the time?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
After the state elections, Steve had a meeting with a lot of the people that he'd put in power, from the governor on down to the school boards. And he had them all stand and swear that they would ask him before they made any decisions, and including the governor, Ed Jackson. And so only two people in the room refused. One of them was a prosecutor just north of Indianapolis named Bill Ramey, and who becomes a very important figure later on. So Ramey didn't, and the Indianapolis Times didn't, but he had pretty much everything else sewed up. So the unraveling of the Klan came, I think, from inner strife within the Klan. I mean, it turns out that the qualities that make you a good Klansman are not really good team-building skills. So they were doing each other in, one after another. So that was part of it. But the second thing was the publicity over Steve's trial went national. And in the process of the trial, a lot of the inner workings of the Klan came to light all across the country. So it was a big, scandalous trial.
And it also sort of appealed to a central tenet of what this Klan claimed to be, which was law-abiding.
That's right.
And if Absolutely. The head official is committing rape and violent assault, they're obviously not against a librarian of all folks.
Right, right.
It's obviously not law-abiding, and so that probably changed public opinion greatly.
Yes, I think that was a really big part of it. And then, so later, Steve turned against the Klan. And so even in later years, he began to talk about all this stuff. And really,
he held a lot of the state government hostage after
yes.
he was convicted because
yes.
he basically said, I'm going to expose all your Klan ties to all these guys who had taken their oath to him.
He could not believe that the governor didn't pardon him, but he was too hot for the governor to pardon. So I want to tell you a little bit about the trial. John Niblock covered the trial, and Bill Ramey, the prosecutor who wasn't owned by Steve, was the prosecutor. Otherwise, without those two things, I would not have had a book because the transcript has long since disappeared. So what I did was, I never have any money on these projects, but I went to Indianapolis, actually Franklin, Indiana, and stayed in a college dorm and researched the old newspapers. So I came home with rolls of microfilm. This was in the 90s, late 80s and early 90s that I did this part. This book has taken me years.
Mm-hmm.
And I transcribed all those news stories. And that's how I wrote the chapters on the trial. But it was a labor of love because they are beautifully written. I could not believe it. The transcript couldn't be as good because Niblock's work is just awesome. He speaks of a tick-tock of the clock.
Mm-hmm.
And this one chewing gum, and they're amazing stories. So that's how I got that piece of it. So, as I said, during the trial, a lot of things came to light about the Klan, and I think my thesis is that the Klan thereafter, about 1925, began to fall, and never again has it been considered a respectable organization fit for civilized society. So I feel that this story is very important, and especially at this moment in history, I think it's very important.
Now, you've written some op-eds too about the parallels between today's election and say the 1920s. What do you see as parallels today?
What I see happening today is very frightening to me, because I see a candidate who has identified some of our darkest fears and capitalized on them and made it almost respectable in some people's opinions to become a white supremacist, to hate other people. We're approaching the moment in this country when people like you and I will be in a minority. I now live in a town, Orlando, that is very multicultural. It is a wonderful experience. It's a great experience. There are people there from all over the world. You know, you walk down the street and you hear many different languages. That's what a wonderful experience, I think, to live in a society like that.
That's profoundly frightening to other people.
How the nation handles this transition, I think, is going to make or break us. That's what it looks like to me. But I see the same sort of tactics being used in this election that were used to create power with the Klan. And perhaps my friend Normie Eagleton said to me yesterday, it's the rise of fascism around the world that is going on, and maybe so. I'm not deep enough to know all that. But anyway, that's so it's one of the reasons that I have pushed now at my advanced age to get this book published, to get this story out as broadly as I can. I think there are lessons to be learned from the 1920s Ku Klux Klan, and I think we need those lessons right now.
One last question. I know you're now a resident of Orlando, Florida, so you've been following events from afar in our own little situation here back in Tulsa, which involves a figure that's on a building or was on a building here on the University of Tulsa campus, John Rogers, and his involvement with the Klan in this 20s Klan. And, of course, this has been a big subject of debate. The university made a decision to remove his name from the building. And, you know, this has been weeks, and you still see letters to the editor in the newspaper just about every few days. I know you're seeing this from afar, but knowing what you know about the 20s Klan, do you have any opinions about what's been going on here?
I have opinions. I don't have a lot of real knowledge. Yeah. So I think it's heartbreaking. And I've noticed now that I'm back in town visiting for a little bit, that almost the first question people ask me is, well, what do you think about the John Rogers thing? What do you think about that? And I can tell that a lot of people are really upset about it. So I think the Klan and the spirit of the Klan wrecks lives. That's what I think. I think it wrecks the lives of the victims. It wrecks the people who were sucked into it for a while. And it wrecks anybody who carries that kind of spirit in their heart through their lives. I think that's it's an evil thing. And I think that I think it's very sad to see this happening in the city I love.
The name of the book is Unmasked, The Rise and Fall of the 1920s Ku Klux Klan. And it's always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rich.
Ann Patton is the author of Unmasked, The Rise and Fall of the 1920s Ku Klux Klan. She'll be conducting several signings around the area, the first of which will be at the Florence Park Cafe at 3144 East 15th from 1 to 3 this Saturday. For more signing information, visit her website at annpatton.net. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own, do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.